And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on KBOO, up next is Political Perspectives. That is followed at 10 by Air Cascadia with Chris Andre, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints continues coverage of the expanding fighting in Iraq. Also, peace activists will gather on Saturday in cities around the country to oppose U.S. involvement in the war. And we hear excerpts of a forum recorded recently in San Francisco on the battle against Israeli apartheid rule in Palestine. And at 11 on the food show, we hear from Dan Barber, author of The Third Plate, Notes on the Future of Food, and from Sam Andramariam, owner of Miriam Foods, who has recently started a food business inspired by Ethiopian cuisine, and with David Sachs, author of The Tastemakers. Thanks for listening to KBOO Radio, and thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the third annual What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd in Duver, Oregon. What the Festival is an annual electronics festival which this year features the Glitch Mob, Washed Out, Nightmares on Wax, and more. There will also be a hookah lounge, relaxation huts, and the largest disco ball on the West Coast. Again, that's What the Festival, June 20th through 23rd at the Wolf Run Ranch in Duver, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
June 20th, 2014, Stories from the Streets is a groundbreaking celebration at Pioneer Square in Portland, Oregon, dedicated to exploring the life of hip-hop in the Pacific Northwest. Our mission is to raise awareness on the positive influences and lifelong benefits that hip-hop culture has had on our homeless youth and our community. All proceeds and donations from Stories from the Streets will directly benefit New Avenues for Youth Nonprofit Artist Mentorship Project. There will be graffiti, breakdancing, DJing, and rapping. Artists include Soul Miner, The Resistance, Black Butterfly, Ancient Soul, Mike Crenshaw, Lucky I Am of Living Legends, and DJ Andy Sparks. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. June 20th from 12 to 9 p.m. in Pioneer Square in downtown Portland.
This morning on Political Perspectives, we hear a talk by professor and activist Nahanda Imara. She spoke on Pan-Africanism and the need for African people and all of humanity to organize. That was at the Law and Disorder Conference, which was held at Portland State University in May.
Greetings, everyone. I'm H, and I'm here representing the All African People's Revolutionary Party. I'm standing up here because I have the honor to introduce a sister from the organization. She's a sister from the Ghana chapter and the Oakland chapter, California chapter, actually. She's part of the All African Women's Union also. And she's down and she really knows what she's talking about environmental justice, because it's affecting us worldwide. And so I want to have the pleasure to introduce Sister Nahanda Imara to come up to the mic and bless us with some of her knowledge.
I'm honored to be here. My first time in Portland, and I'm only here for a couple of days, but it's always good when you come to a new place that you are making a contribution and you're not just coming and being a consumer or just coming and, you know, collecting information and making your head big. So I'm here to contribute and give you something, and hoping that it's not just going to make your heads big, but it's going to make you want to take action and do something, because I think that's the most important thing for us to do with information and knowledge. So I'm really happy to be here. As Brother H said, I'm an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party, and that's been for about 33 years. The All African People's Revolutionary Party is an independent African revolutionary Pan-African organization. We are not a part of the nonprofit industrial complex. But I do also work for a nonprofit organization called Communities for a Better Environment. I'm an organizer in East Oakland community in Northern California. And Communities for a Better Environment, we get, you know, funding from some of the more progressive foundations. And so even though we are a part of the nonprofit industrial complex, we are doing some good work. Some of you have probably heard of CBE. We stand up and fight against big corporate powers like Chevron in Richmond, California. We've been fighting them for a long time. So I'm honored to be a part of both of these organizations because they are trying to do something for humanity, for the environment, and particularly for African people. So part of those two organizations, I also teach part-time at Merritt Community College, the home of the Black Panther Party. Merritt Community College was the first place that Black studies was ever taught in this country. I know we have somebody here from San Francisco State, and some of y'all think that it was San Francisco State, but we know it was Oakland. Okay, just here to tell you the truth, that's all. So yeah, so I'm also proud to be a part of Merritt Community College. I teach African American studies there part-time, and I teach in a course called Environmental Racism, Environmental Justice. It's a course that I created that is from the, it is cross-taught between the Environmental Studies and the African American Studies Department. Why am I here today, and why am I glad to be here today? Yeah, I think it's important that we share some ideas with you today on our topic, Pan-Africanism, and we're definitely going to get into this concept of Quilomboism, which is the term that comes out of Bahia, Brazil, particularly Brazil. And we're definitely going to connect that to our presentation. So I definitely am pleased to be able to share with you some of these ideas that I've learned along the way in these different capacities that I have gathered as an organizer. But I actually want to start with a poem by Pablo Neruda. And I saw this poem in a book that I'm yet to read, but I want to read, by Arundhati Roy, called her new book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. But I thought it was appropriate to start off with a poem, and this poem, some of you know that last month was, April was Poetry Month, Poetry History Month. This month is African Liberation Month. You know, I'm not sure if it's healthy to compartmentalize our history into months. Some might think that that's a sign of diversity or democracy. It may be a sign of laziness, I'm not sure, because then, you know, we only study women during Women's History Month. We only study Africa during African History Month in February. We only read poetry in April. But for me, you know, every month is African Liberation Month. So May is African Liberation Month. But so I wanted to start off with this poem by Pablo Neruda. Your blood asks, how were the wealthy and the law interwoven? With what sulfurous iron fabric? How did the poor keep falling into the tribunals? How did the land become so bitter for poor children, harshly nourished on stone and grief? So it was, and so I leave it written, their lives wrote on my brow. I thought that was suiting for the topic of this conference, Law and Disorder. And so as I said, I heard Arundhati Roy, the Indian writer, talking about her new book, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. And in the first chapter, she opens up with this poem by the Chilean poet Neruda. And so I started with a poem because it made me think about a Nigerian author that I love, Chimamanda Adichie. You guys heard of her? She did a TED talk called The Danger of a Single Story. Anybody seen it? And for me, you know, she gives us a really important perspective on the importance of understanding that we are all influenced by sort of this dominant racist Western narrative, and it influences all of us. It influences all of us in the sense that we're taught through a European imperialist lens so that my history in Africa starts when Europeans colonize Africa, or my history starts here in the African diaspora with slavery, and that this kind of dominant Western racist narrative makes for a single story, and there's a danger in that. But I also wanted to refer to her because she made me think that there's also another danger in telling our stories in the movement from a single perspective. I don't know if there was there any art and culture in this conference this whole time? There was. Yay! Because I think it's important that we put art and culture back into the movement. And oftentimes, you know, we are telling our story from a certain kind of, you know, just a political perspective, and we forget that the cultural arts and the language that it uses is also an important part of the movement. I almost asked this poet up here to come up and do a poem before I started, but maybe she'll do one at the end. Because it's important in building our movements that we capture the heart and the souls and, you know, not just the minds, but the heart and souls of a people. And I think the cultural arts are an important tool to do that. I have to draw on the Black Panthers, again, from Oakland as a great example because, you know, the Panthers gives us so much rich political activism. You know, they gave us the first Black Studies Department. They gave us the first free clinics and sickle cell anemia testing. They gave us self-defense against police brutality. They gave us Black Power. You know, they gave us so much. But how many of you knew they had a musical band called the Lumpin'? Somebody knew. You know, so even the Panthers, and as, you know, as radical and as militant and as revolutionary as they were, they understood the importance of art in the movement and culture in the movement. And so that's why I start off with this poem. Earlier today, we were talking about Gil Scott-Heron. And had it not been for him, I would not have known about the Watergate Blues, H2O Watergate Blues, from the perspective that he taught us in that song. And Tuskegee 626, you know, the story about infecting Black men with syphilis to see, you know, what would happen, you know. And I learned about these things not from the movement, because at that time, I think I was in high school, telling my age, but, you know, listening to Gil Scott, I was able to learn about these things and connect to the movement, even, you know, because it's like planting seeds, you know, and then later on, you know, I'm like, wow, okay, I remember Gil Scott talked about that. R.I.P. Gil Scott. And so that's why I started off with this. I'm not an expert on Neruda. Somebody may be in here. I haven't read Arundhati Roy's book, but I want to, Capitalism, A Ghost Story. But what I sense and what I think about them is that Roy and Neruda, they both had a clear belief that capitalism is a failed system. Would you agree?
Yes.
All right. I'm in good company. Capitalism is an evil system that is on a path to privatize everything, where the banks get bailouts and the dollar enjoys free speech and corporations are persons. From my perspective as an African, as a Pan-Africanist, capitalism is the root of all evils. It is built on unjust, racist, classist, sexist system off of 400 years of illegal chattel slavery of African people. It is militaristic terrorism on steroids. And surely it can last no longer than chattel slavery did. So capitalism will fall. Capitalism is dead. I don't want to spend too much time on that because I think we all agree on that. As an environmental justice advocate and activist, capitalism is killing the planet. The entire ecological crisis we are currently facing is nothing more than the greedy quest of capitalist interest for dirty energy that pollutes the air, water, and all life. It is the cause of food deserts, food insecurity, obesity, land grabs, mountaintop removal at the expense of our health, and especially low-income communities and communities of color, developing countries whose resources are exploited, forests decimated, water rights stolen, of which Africa is a primary target. In the desperate attempt, capitalism today is greenwashing itself. So we have to be real careful. claiming to develop renewable energy from sugarcane and palm oil that they are growing in Brazil and Africa and other places in the world while killing the forest, killing the Amazon, and making imperialist land grabs. So capitalism will fall. Capitalism is dead. Can y'all say that with me? Capitalism will fall. Capitalism is dead. Amen. Woo, let's bury it. Let's have the funeral soon. But today I want to talk about Pan-Africanism. And, you know, if you all, during the question and answer period, also want to ask me about my work as an environmental justice advocate, activist, and organizer, I'd be happy to do that. But today I'm here primarily in my role as an organizer with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. We said May is African Liberation Month. May 19th is the birthday of Malcolm X. And May 25th is African Liberation Day. And if any of you are in the Oakland area, you can participate with us. But there's all over the African world, African Liberation Day will be celebrated on May 25th. For the All African People's Revolutionary Party, we will be celebrating in several countries in West Africa, Ghana, Guinea-Bissau, countries in East Africa, Tanzania, Southern Africa. We'll be celebrating in the Caribbean, London, and in several places in the U.S. Check out African Liberation Day. Check out our website. And so Malcolm X taught us that of all our studies, history best rewards our research. If you find out how someone else solved a problem that they had in history, you might be able to find some strategies to solve yours. And so today I'm here to say that when we look at our history for African people, people of African descent, our history tells us that Pan-Africanism is our only solution. Pan-Africanism is our only solution. And there's a reason that Pan-Africanism is written out of history, even though it's been around over 200 years. It's probably something that's not taught here at this university. I know it's not taught at the universities I went to. I teach it now at Merit, but that's because of who I am and I teach. But Pan-Africanism has been around for over 200 years as an organized movement. And yet, today, many of us know little about it. And there's a reason for that. There are reasons that there are forces that don't want us to know about Pan-Africanism. But without understanding Pan-Africanism and the forces of, against it, we will not understand how we as an African people got in the situation and in the position that we are in today globally. Without understanding Pan-Africanism and that history, we will not know how we arrived in our current situation globally. There's no society without culture. And consequently, there's no society without civilization. There are neither superior or inferior civilizations. Each people proceeding from their own culture, using their own intellectual power, their moral and physical capabilities, come to work with nature and create their own history. This forward march is eternal. It's evolutionary. And it's moving you to higher and higher levels of civilization. Africa was following on this path of universal evolutionary development of its civilization, from smaller to larger social organizations, from family to clan to nation to continent. Africa, if she had been left untrampled by colonialism, imperialism, and slavery, would have already arrived at continental unity. We would already have Pan-Africanism. We can see this if we study history, if we study it, especially if you study it from an African lens. You certainly won't see this if you study it from the dominant Western European imperialist lens. And so Africa, if she had been left untrampled, would have already arrived at continental unity. But that free development was brutally interrupted by the aggression of European imperialist powers against the people of Africa. From the 15th to the 19th century, Africa was dominated by foreign powers who came to civilize her. During this period, imperialism wreaked havoc in Africa in every area of life through cultural, spiritual, and military aggression. More than 300 million sons and daughters of Africa were taken from Africa during this period. And, you know, I know the numbers are always like underestimated. There's a lot of suppressed history about how many slave ships, how many ships with enslaved Africans were simply for insurance reasons. You know, this the whole history of European slave trade built the whole financial institutions of this capitalist system today, the banking system, the loan systems. And so there's a new book out, I thought I wrote it down, by Greg Granson. Anybody know what book I'm talking about? The Necessity of Empire. Empire of Necessity, yeah, and it's about the myth about slavery and freedom and the slave trade. And he talks about how, you know, there were cases where if a shipload of enslaved Africans were sick and not worthy of taking to their next spot and being sold, they would simply be dumped overboard as an insurance loss. Because after all, this was just property. This was just chattel slavery. And so I say 300 million Africans were lost during this aggressive period of Western imperialism between the 15th and 19th century. And that's some devastation that it takes a long time for a society, for a civilization to heal from. But finally, in the 20th century, Pan-Africanism found its early organizational expression. In 1900, the first convening of the first Pan-African conference, led by a barrister named Henry Sylvester Williams, an African born in Trinidad. And this conference had a vision, and it was very clear. It was anti-imperialist, it was anti-colonialist, and it was calling on Africa's sons and daughters that had been scattered all over the world, struggling and suffering, to coordinate their thinking and bring their actions in a unified way to fight against colonial oppression. And this first conference passed many resolutions that called for greater unity among African people and in their battle against European imperialists. This was 1900, and that's why I say this movement has been in its organized expression for over 200 years. And it was always anti-imperialist and anti-colonialist. And so today, there's no way that any person of African descent could think that there's any way to greenwash, any way to put lipstick on capitalism. There's just no way that we could think that capitalism it has anything for us. Historically, that just doesn't make sense. By 1919, W.E. Du Bois convened the first Pan-African Congress. So the first one was a conference. Congress, we're starting to feel a little bit more empowered. A Congress makes stronger demands. And Du Bois was actually at the first one in 1900. But the ones that followed from 1919 to 1945, W.E.B. Du Bois had a very strong leadership role in those. They're called the Du Boisian Pan-African Congresses. And at the same time, in the 1920s, we see the Marcus Garvey Back to Africa movement heating up. And so you have this sort of Pan-African Congresses happening in Europe, and then you have this mass grassroots Pan-African movement organized by the Universal Negro Improvement Association and African Leagues, incorporated by Marcus Garvey, presiding out of Jamaica. And so his movement is starting to bring mass character, grassroots character, to the Pan-African movement. And you had Africans in his movement from Nova Scotia, Canada, all the way, members and chapters all the way in Azania, South Africa, who joined to help build his Universal Negro Improvement Association. His publications were translated in like four different languages and read all throughout the African world. And today we think we need social media. You guys don't like my jokes. 5 4 languages, you know. And in some countries in Africa, it was banded. If you had his one of Garvey's magazines, you could be put in jail. And so some folks were taught how to read, memorize it, and take it to the villages and repeat it to the villages and to the folks in the community, because that's how powerful his message was, Africa for the Africans at home and abroad. And so Du Bois presided over five Pan-African Congresses from 1919 to 1945, which were held in both the United States and Europe. The first four were concerned primarily with making stronger protests and against imperial powers, trying to get redress against the brutal exploitation and discrimination of Africans worldwide. The dominant strategy of these Congresses was to appeal to the conscience of these governments. But by the fifth Pan-African Congress in 1945 in Manchester, England, you know, folks get tired of just asking you, you know, politely, can you please stop, you know, can you please take your foot off my neck? And so by 1945, you see the Pan-African Congress in Manchester having a more mass character. There was labor unions there for the first time, students. You saw people like Kwame Nkrumah, who we're going to talk about. You saw people like Jomo Kenyatta, Nnamdi Azikiwe, these folks who later would become the heads of state of their countries for the first time, becoming independent from colonialism. And so that Manchester Conference 1945 is seen as one that that took a qualitative and quantitative leap in terms of Pan-Africanism as a movement. Most of them, as I said, were workers and students, and so it had this grassroots character. In fact, Marcus Garvey's first wife, Amy Garvey, participated in the conference. And if we know anything about Marcus Garvey, he fought his whole life for Africa, but unfortunately he never set foot in Africa. But his wife carried on that legacy. Actually, both of his wives, who were both named Amy. That's a whole other story. But I would love to come back and tell that one. And so the fifth Pan-African Congress demanded the organization of mass political parties. It was anti-capitalist in nature, and it called for the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism as the solution and final confrontation against colonialism. Pan-Africanism pronounces its socialist aspirations at this conference. It would take all of my time to list all the Pan-African leadership that has made great contributions to this movement, a leadership coming from all over the world, and a leadership that continues today. I know some of you have heard of Marcus Garvey. Many of you have not heard of Amy Jacques Garvey or Amy Ashwood Garvey, who was the co-founder of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Some of you may have heard of Abdias Nascimento, a Pan-Africanist from Brazil, George Padmore, Amilcar Cabral, Sami Nkrumah, Kwame Ture, Anna Julia Cooper, Shirley Graham Du Bois, who, after she and Du Bois moved to Ghana for the last 2 years of his life, she stayed on and worked with Dr. Nkrumah when he became president of Ghana. Luisa Mahin, a revolutionary woman from Bahia, Brazil, Sekou Touré, and so many others. I could use the rest of my time listing them from all over the African world. And so it's important that you know that this movement is very diverse, it's very broad, and it's still alive. Sami Nkrumah is still with us today. The rest of those folks up there are ancestors, but they are also with us in the African belief system. But I must give special attention to Osagyefo Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. I must say here that the history of the world would not be complete until the influence of Nkrumah as a man of world peace, a beacon for unity of all African people, and as a symbol of a unified socialist Africa is recognized. Every African owes Dr. Nkrumah a huge debt. Without his contributions, his strategic thinking, his ideological precision, and his dedicated work to building Pan-Africanism and the United States of Africa, we would be centuries behind in the movement for African liberation. Just as African people owe Haiti a debt for its historic and heroic legacy for African agency, military acumen, and black consciousness, we can say the same thing about Dr. Nkrumah. Again, Haiti, that would be a whole nother topic, but we know the importance of Haiti being the first independent black nation in the Western Hemisphere and the example that it gave to enslaved Africans around the world to fight against slavery. So we owe a debt to Dr. Nkrumah and we owe a debt to Haiti. Nkrumah, at the dawn of his independence, so Nkrumah's at the 5th Pan-African Congress, 1945, and he is one of the main organizers with Du Bois. And these folks, they leave the 45 Congress and they go back to their respective countries because many of them have been studying abroad in Europe. And Nkrumah, of course, studied for 10 years in the U.S. at Lincoln University in Philadelphia. But in 1945, it was time to go home and put the movement on the ground. So Nkrumah leaves and goes and creates the Convention People's Party. And by 1957, at Ghana's independence, Nkrumah makes this statement at the inaugural address. He says, "Ghana's independence is meaningless unless it is linked up with the total liberation of the African continent. The concept of African unity embraces the fundamental needs and characteristics of African civilization and ideology, and at the same time satisfies all the conditions necessary for an accelerated economic and technological advance." And so from 1957 until the CIA overthrew Ghana and Nkrumah and his Convention People's Party in 1966, Nkrumah was the most important ideologue and practitioner of Pan-Africanism. Every liberation movement in Africa had bases in Ghana, whether it was ZANU, Zimbabwe African National Union, ANC, PAC, Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania. Every liberation movement, Ghana was a base. It was a liberated zone. And so it's no wonder that he became a target of Western imperialist aggression. And his party and his government was overthrown. Many Ghanaians were on the payroll of the CIA. And all this is, you know, what do they call it when it's put out, the CIA papers or whatever. Declassified, thank you. I need help, this is participatory. So his ascent to becoming the most important Pan-Africanist theoretician and practitioner also led to him becoming a target, as we said. And so his government was overthrown. But he gave us a blueprint. When the coup came, he actually went to Guinea, another West African country that was being led by Ahmed Sekou Touré and his People's Democratic Party of Guinea, which was also another revolutionary Pan-African country at that time. There were very few Nkrumah, Sekou Touré at this time in the late 50s and 60s. Sekou Touré says, "Come to Guinea and be co-president." That's never happened in the history of the world that I know where someone says, come and be co-president. And Nkrumah went to Guinea. He wasn't in exile. He was still in Africa. He was planning and every day until his death in 71, I think, he was planning for Pan-African Revolution and to get back to Ghana. And during that time, he gave us the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare as the strategy and as the blueprint that now that he had been overthrown, you know, he had a lot of different strategies that he thought were necessary to take us to the complete path and to the completion of Pan-African Revolutionary Unity, the United States of Africa. And so in the Handbook of Revolutionary Warfare, Dr. Nkrumah calls for the creation of an all-African People's Revolutionary Party. It's in this book. Somebody had the book earlier today. I don't know if you still have it. There it is. It's in there. And he calls for the creation of this party to organize and politically educate the African masses. This revolutionary Pan-African party is the vehicle that has grown from the organic struggle of African people's desire to achieve Pan-African unity. Africa historically has been on an evolutionary path, as we said, towards it. And so this blueprint is to speed that process up to a revolutionary path, a path that we were already headed for. And so in calling for the AAPRP to achieve the final stage of Pan-Africanism, Nkrumah understood that only the people, so, you know, you had these Africans coming out of the 5th Pan-African Congress going back and fighting and liberating. By 1960, I think over two-thirds of the continent had become liberated, and we can draw a direct link from the militancy and the need to organize mass political parties that came from that 1945 that led to, by 1960, over two-thirds of the continent now had, in terms of those colonial boundaries, become liberated, politically liberated. And so when Nkrumah wrote this book, he realized that in order to take us on this final path, that the movement had to be from the grassroots up. He had fought while he was in power to create the United States of Africa, but there weren't enough Pan-African revolutionary forces, and so what we got was the Organization of African Unity. And now it's called the AU, the African Unity, African Union. We can't even model ourselves after our own culture. We got to model ourselves after Europe. You know, there's the European Union. So now the Organization of African Unity is now called the African Union. So you see, we've, you know, Nkrumah, forgive us, we've gone, I don't know how many steps back, since you tried to tell us what we needed, the United States of Africa. And so Pan-Africanism is a worldwide movement, and it is alive today. And we believe in the All African People's Revolutionary Party that it will solve all the conflicts we see in Africa today. Because once you have an identity, an ideology that you're African, and not just African, because there's some folks who know they're African, but that you are a Pan-African, then being a Yoruba or being a Muslim or being a Nigerian or being a Igbo or being a Ga is less than being a Pan-African. And so Pan-Africanism still is alive today. Today it has to be built from the grassroots up, not from the top down. And Nkrumah fought for this United States of Africa. And so again, at this stage, we are organizing at the mass level. Pan-Africanism is alive and well. Before I get to Brazil, I just have two stories about that, which I just love. I spent a lot of time in Ghana, as Brother H said, and Nkrumah's daughter, Samia Nkrumah, she came back to Ghana, I forgot what year, I think 2007, 2008, to live in Ghana and to carry on the legacy of her father, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah. And I was in Ghana in 2009, and I had the pleasure of meeting her. She had just been elected a member of parliament in the Joromo state, and one of the poorest states in Ghana, regions, districts. And she was very humble, very clear that she wanted to lead her Convention People's Party, her father's party, back to becoming the revolutionary Pan-Africanist party it was, because it's not today. But that that she understood that that was her role. So for me, this meant that Pan-Africanism, the Pan-Africanism that Nkrumah wanted, the United States of Africa that he wanted, is still alive today through his daughter. She's now the chair of the Convention People's Party. It didn't win in the elections that Ghana had a couple years ago. It's still a fledgling party. But for me, as a Pan-Africanist, you know, it speaks to the fact that that legacy is still alive. And so, you know, when we talk about some of these ancestors who are not here anymore, but, you know, are still here, well, there are folks who are still here doing this work at that level that Nkrumah wanted for us. And so she speaks about, she told us, when I met her, she told us that that many people were telling her and pulling her coat and saying, oh, you know, your name, your father, she looks just like her father. You could be making so much money. You could have big houses. And she's like, no, that's not why I'm here. I'm here to bring back the dignity of Africa, to bring back the dignity of African people in Africa, in Ghana, and everywhere in the African diaspora. And, you know, there's a lot of corrupt leadership around the world. And so when you have leaders like that who understand their role, it makes me know and appreciate that Pan-Africanism is alive. Another example, in 2011, I was in Ghana. I spent 6 months in Ghana in 2011, and I had the pleasure of traveling with Dr. Julius Garvey, Marcus Garvey's son. Oh, that was amazing. He is a surgeon in New York, and he is quietly doing work in Ghana and in Africa, supporting and funding sustainable agricultural projects. You know, so from his perspective, this is the work that he's doing at a grassroots level to build up that kind of Pan-African vision that his father, Marcus Garvey, had. And so for me, we traveled to like 7 of the 11 regions in Ghana for like a 5-day trip to visiting all these sustainable agricultural projects that he was supporting. And just very humble man, just very committed to quietly doing this work. So, you know, you're not going to hear about Samia Nkrumah or Dr. Julius Garvey on CNN, ABC, CIA, FBI. You're not going to hear about it. But, you know, so unless I was here today, or, you know, Brother Jamun H and other folks who are here to let you know that Pan-Africanism is alive, you wouldn't know. You just wouldn't know that this important work is being done. And so another place and another space where this work is being done that really inspired me is in Bahia, Brazil. But anywhere African people are, this work is being done. I'm convinced. I had the honor to go with 12 educators for a month last year, the month of December, through Merritt College African American Studies Department, where I teach. And we were there to meet grassroots activists, youth, students, elected officials, all kind of folks who were doing grassroots work, spiritual leaders, cultural leaders in Bahia, Brazil. And as I've mentioned, I've spent a lot of time outside of the U.S. in Africa and the Caribbean, Haiti, Cuba, Belize, several countries in Africa. Most of my time has been in Ghana. But my time in Bahia, Brazil was really, really, really special. It was really, really a powerful. It added a powerful dimension to my thinking as an activist, and as a Pan-African activist, and as an environmental justice activist because of what I learned. And so that visit for that month in Brazil stood out as a really important, inspiring visit for me. Now, I knew as a Pan-Africanist that Brazil has the largest number of African people outside of Africa. I knew that. But to be there and experience that and feel that in terms of what that really means, because of course we know that between West Africa and Brazil, that's the shortest distance. Those slave ships only took 30 days. To get to other parts, it took much longer, 3 times that long. And so consequently, at the peak of the European slave trade, and especially at the peak of growing sugar cane, there were millions of Africans just being brought across this land. And most of these Africans were taken from that region where there were Yoruba and Fa and different cultural groups that were all brought into this place in Brazil, primarily in Bahia. And so the Portuguese, you know, they were the ones leading this part of the slave trade. They thought by putting all these Africans together from all these different cultural groups that would keep them divided and confused, because, you know, that's what people say, oh, there's too many languages, there's confusion. But it the opposite happened. These Africans created some beautiful Pan-African unity and African cultural expressions. And so there's 3 things that came out of that that were highlights of that visit for me. And that is what I learned about Candomblé, which is an African philosophy, an African way of life that was created in Bahia, Brazil, by Africans from several different regions in Africa, and it shows the power and the cultural unity of Africa, that these Africans come in and speaking Fanti and Ga and Angola and speaking different languages would come via the slave trade and then create a unified African philosophy way of life called Candomblé. You know, I knew what, I'd heard of it, but I really didn't know what it was. I didn't know. So Candomblé, Quilombos, these are independent African communities that were created from the beginning of slavery by Africans in Brazil, similar to what the Maroons did in Jamaica when they fled and went up into the mountains and created their own independent spaces. And so in Brazil, they're called Quilombos. And then on this trip, practically everyone, the majority of the leaders, whether it was spiritual leaders, capoeira leaders, cultural arts performers, youth leaders, leaders fighting police brutality, the majority of them were African women. And that was so inspiring. And so, again, even though it's not new to me to know that African women are in the forefront of our struggle, to actually see it in Brazil and see it at this high, intense level, it's inspiring because, you know, in our work here, you know, we see it, but sometimes it gets diffused. And so Candomblé is an African way of life. It's an African philosophy. It's not a religion in the sense that in the West we think of religion, you know, as this one day a week thing, you know, like on Sunday this or a Friday or, you know, this one day a week. Candomblé is a way of life, a 24/7 way of life. And it is not a synthesis of African spiritual practices synthesized with Catholicism. It is not that. It is a synthesis of African philosophy and spiritual practices. It sometimes hid behind Catholicism, but it is not synthesized with Catholicism in no way. And this is what we learned, and this is what we were told, and this is what we were taught. And this is what we studied when we, before going on this trip, and what we learned while we were there. And so, Candomblé is a Pan-African synthesis of African philosophy from several regions in Africa that we were taken from. Through Candomblé, Africans in Brazil developed a sense of community, a Pan-African unity. This community spirit gave them the wherewithal for coping, eventually resisting the awful lot in store for them. Candomblé became a means of resistance and survival. And many, and some of us know, and we've heard about the Orishas, and we think that they're deities or gods. They are not. They are energies of nature. And so, you know, this just blew me away as a Pan-Africanist and as an environmentalist. I'm like, yes, energies of nature, yes. And so I'm not an expert in Candomblé, not an expert in the Orishas, but every place we went to Candomblé houses, we went to Quilombos, we went to Tejeros. These are spaces where African people created a sense of being in Africa outside of Africa to cope and maintain their sanity and to resist. Every place we visited, they said that Candomblé, the Orishas, is a way of life. They're not deities, they're not gods, it's not a religion. It's our African philosophy, it's our African way of life. And so it's best understood through observing the forces of nature. So Obatala, the creator of all, Shango, the energy of power, Yemanya, the energy of water and the oceans. These are energies, they're not energies of nature. And so Candomblé is an important cultural form of Pan-African resistance that is alive and well in Brazil today. Candomblé is primarily practiced in Quilombos and Tejeros. These are urban kind of compounds where folks are initiated into the way of life. But the Quilombos that were created at the beginning, you know, day one, when Africans landed, they began to escape and create these free spaces to practice their way of life, to grow food, to build family. And it was so interesting. Many Africans who had bought themselves out of slavery during this time period, they would actually go and come from the quilombos, you know, as if they would go and have to work on the plantation and then go to the quilombo like they were going on vacation. But today, I believe over 3,000, maybe as high as 6,000 quilombos still exist in Brazil today as spaces where African people practice an African way of life, where they practice candomblé. And what we were told was that whether it's capoeira, whether it's candomblé, whether it's whatever kind of ritual, these are African spiritual practices that are forms of resistance in the urban environment today, as it was during the enslaved environment that Africans created it. And so candomblé became a tool for these Africans to organize. And quilombos become the spaces where they can just be African. And so today, these quilombos still exist. Many of them are organized in spaces that are close to cities, and they're doing things, organizing youth. And, you know, so they're not just these places where they're going to just, you know, sort of go back to nature and, you know, grow their own food. They're actually still spaces for African resistance. And but the important part about it for me is that it, you know, as a person of African descent, without that space, I was talking with someone earlier, without that space for us to heal, you know, from the evils of slavery, it's just not going to happen on its own. You know, after every kind of trauma, violent event in this country, somebody sends the psychologist to the school. Well, for African people going through 400 years of slavery, nobody has sent me a psychologist yet. And so these spaces were spaces for healing and holding on to your African humanity. You know, and some people, you wonder, how else could we have survived if you know how vicious slavery was? How else could we be the people we are today and not just go berserk on everybody? The only reason I can understand is that we've had these kind of spaces and these kind of places to keep us sane and to give us a sense of hope. And so that's what these quilombos. Someone who was one of the most famous leaders of the longest held quilombo was Zumbi of Palmares. That was the name of another name for the quilombos. Palmares had to do with there being a lot of palm trees. O líder negro de todas as raças. He was a leader, a black leader of all the races. Zumbi died in November, I can't remember what year, over, I think, 300 years ago. And so every November in Brazil is Black Consciousness Month in honor of Zumbi do Palmares and the quilombo that he was the last leader of that lasted the longest in Brazil. As we said, Brazil has the largest population of African outside of Africa. In fact, in my estimation, Brazil is a black country, but many of us don't really know that. Is 52% black. And there's this myth of racial democracy. And everywhere we went, people were like, no, there's no racial democracy here. Racism is alive and well. Over 30,000 black youth are killed because of police brutality or some kind of criminal incident with military police every year, 30,000 black youth. Racism is alive and well in Brazil. And so everywhere we went, we were told that. But with, you know, 52% African people in the country, we still don't have power. We don't have power. We met the first African elected city council person of Salvador. Salvador is a black city, 80-90%. They elected their first city council member of the city of Salvador in 2011. So numbers don't make power. Pan-African organization, Pan-African agency makes power. And so what was especially empowering, though, for me was to see the quality and quantity of African women leadership that we saw there and that we learned about that played a critical role in the liberation of Bahia, one of the most famous rebellions, I think it was 1835, the Mali Rebellion. And Mali, referring to Mali in Africa, where a large number of these Africans were Muslims and who could read and who still practiced Ramadan. And at the peak of Ramadan, you know, this is when some of the most fiercest slave revolts took place in Brazil. And side by side were the sisters. This is Mai Valdina, Mother Valdina, who was a leader of Candomblé that we met, just one of the many, many women that we met that are carrying on the tradition. And so the women during the slavery period and anti-slavery period and today were able to sort of protect and retain Candomblé. And so they had a really important role in the quilombos and in the Candomblé houses. And so this is a modern day quilombo. There are fights to hold on to these because, you know, from if you had generations and generations of families who could trace their lineage back to these land spaces, but there's no paperwork. And now with land grabs and gentrification going on at rapid levels, and the land grabs to, you know, to grow this sugarcane and palm oil for this false renewable energy. A lot of these spaces that Africans still are controlling, they're losing control of them. So there's a fight going on for them to be able to legally and legitimately say that they own the land that these quilombos are on. And so many of the folks who were leading these struggles were women. So these are some women. So we had met them at an earlier visit when they were in Salvador, and then when we went to this rural area. So folks, you know, like me, I'm walking down the streets of Salvador. You don't know if I'm practicing Candomblé. You don't know if I'm a part of Quilombo, but practically everybody in the streets of Bahia belongs to, has some connection to a Quilombo, has some connection to Candomblé, or, you know, something that is a part of this Pan-African agency. I did a report back, and I think I had over 170 slides, and so I can't do justice here with what I learned from that visit, and I'm still processing it and still learning it. But I want to end there because I know you have questions, but I just want to conclude with some of the points that I tried to make, and hopefully I did, that mass Pan-African revolutionary organization is necessary for the total liberation, unification of Africa under scientific socialism. Capitalism is a failed system. The Pan-African movement lives. No movement will be victorious without the full participation of its women. Thank you.
This is a song about change, you see. We say many things about the changing aspects of our lives. We say that since change is inevitable, we should direct the change rather than simply continue to go through the change. We sing a song of revolution as change to the brothers in the Caribbean and Africa, where I'm coming from. The call of a crow. They say, come on now, brother, I want you to fly with me. And can't you see it's time to go? Well, I've been working on this delta underneath burning sun. Like a Mississippi revolution. I feel like where I'm coming from. Feel like where I'm coming from. Feel like where I'm coming from.
And this music is Gil Scott-Heron. He's doing Delta Man, Where I'm Coming From. Before that, we heard a talk by professor and activist Nihandra Imara. She spoke on Pan-Africanism and the need for African people and all of humanity to organize. That was recorded at the Law and Disorder Conference, which was held at Portland State University in May. Stay tuned now for Air Cascadia. Before that, we have this one announcement.
Hey everybody, elections are coming up for the KABU Board of Directors. Right now we're looking for board candidates with skills in finance, new media, and nonprofit development. So if this sounds like you or someone you know, you can download a copy of the board candidate package at kboo.fm or pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The application deadline is midnight June 30th, so don't delay. And thank you for supporting Community Radio, KABU.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, June 18th, 2014, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. First, a few headlines. We're going to be speaking a little later on in the program with our guest, Kevin Zeese.